We lost touch with you on the computer while we were sitting. I could tell because I saw the screen go blank. I guess maybe you guys couldn't tell. And I said, oh, that's so sad, you know, we lost everybody.
You're going to have to speak up more.
Yes, yes, okay. And but then I thought, well, not really. So then I reestablished the connection without the computer, you know, inside. And it worked great. So I did not feel any longer disconnected from all of the people on the computer who I knew were still sitting there. And I didn't really need the electronics, you know, to maintain connection. Anyway, thanks you guys for... Somehow we have enough computers and enough fail-safes that we can keep going. Even though the big monitor seems still not to be working. Anyway, seems like a long time ago, last week, last time we were here. And in that time, in the interim, I was in Vancouver for a weekend session, which was something that I do at this weekend every year for many decades, but of course haven't done it for 3 years. So it was a big deal, right? And everybody was very glad to see me, and I was glad to see them. And always a lot of people come, and it's a chance to reconnect with people. And I just, a one-sentence report that our Mountain Rain Zen community in Vancouver is really doing great. They're thriving, they have lots and lots of people coming. They have lots of young people, so they're taking care of that for us. They got lots of young people, and also they have a lot of diversity, because Vancouver is a very diverse population, so... it was wonderful. And our priests there, Kate and Michael, who are very inspiring Zen priests, are doing well. And I know Jean and Neil saw them just days before the weekend in Austin when there was a meeting of Suzuki Roshi-related sanghas in Austin. So they're doing well. Also, since we were together last week, and many of you know this, but some of you probably don't know this. Jane Flint, who's here on the computer, I can see her little square over there. Jane lost her husband, Jim, who passed away a couple days ago, Monday night at 10 p.m. So that is something that was very close to the heart of our sangha the whole time. And when I was reading Thich Nhat Hanh's book to prepare for tonight, I read a passage that reminded me of what Jane has been through. It's on page 61. He writes, "When someone is about to die, if you sit with him stably and solidly, that alone may be enough to help him leave this life with ease. Your presence is like a mantra, sacred speech that has a transformative effect. When your body, speech, and mind are in perfect oneness, that mantra will have an effect even before you utter a word." And when I read that, I really thought of Jane and Jim. This was in a section where Thich Nhat Hanh is talking about mindfulness and breathing. And I know that that is exactly what Jane was doing. She was sitting quietly with Jim and holding his hand for a long, long time, a timeless amount of time, until he passed. So I think right now our hearts are all aligned with Jane's heart and with Jim's, wherever he is. And so let's us too take just a few moments to breathe stably and solidly in oneness with Jane and Jim. Really glad you're here tonight, Jane. And I think you know that if you need anything, you can reach out to any of us. So we'll go on with our study of basic teachings as Thich Nhat Hanh presents them in his book, The Heart of the Buddha's Teaching. Last time we talked a bit about the Four Noble Truths and about the truth of suffering and the transformation of suffering through the path. So the next eight chapters are on the Eightfold Noble Path. So tonight I think I'm going to talk about the first three, sort of, not exactly, because you know, the usual order, the traditional order of the Eightfold Path is right view or right understanding is first, and then second is right intention, which Thich Nhat Hanh sees as right thinking, and that's followed by right speech, right action, right livelihood, then right effort, which Thich Nhat Hanh interprets as right diligence, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And mindfulness is the seventh, but when Thich Nhat Hanh discusses these, he discusses the first and the second, and then he discusses mindfulness third, because mindfulness, as we know, is something that he emphasized a lot. I was thinking about this. I don't know whether it's because of him that we have the mindfulness movement. It might be, you know, I don't know whether he's the one who really and truly made the powerful case for mindfulness, but anyway, certainly it's really important for him, so he discusses it third. So that's what I'm going to cover tonight a little bit, just say a few things about right view, right thinking, and right mindfulness. So the Eightfold Path is the way that we transform suffering from painful and tragic to beautiful. So it's a kind of, you could see it as a kind of progression, you know, you start here and you go down the path, but a progression that is also circular, because when you get to the end, you start over again. In other words, you start with right view, which you already have, otherwise you wouldn't be here, right? Nobody comes to practice unless they begin with the right view, which causes them to come, unless they come somehow by mistake, thinking that it was an AA meeting or some other thing, and they just, you know, mistakenly showed up. But even then, you know, it's probably still they have right view. And then because of that right view, you have some involvement with the practice, and because of that involvement with the practice, you eventually develop right thinking. And if you develop right thinking, that's going to influence you to practice right speech. And because of the thinking and the speech, that's going to condition you to right action, and eventually right livelihood. You'll feel the need for right livelihood. And when you do all of that, then your life is already sort of clarified enough so that you begin to practice the more intensive cultivations of right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation that will, or concentration, that will deepen your insight. So then your right view will be stronger and deeper than it was in the beginning, which will then go through the other seven members of the path until you come to the end. It's even deeper and you start over again. So you go on and on and on. As you know, in Soto Zen, we just say do Zazen and the rest of it all kind of follows. Another way to see the eight is to understand that each one includes all the others. So if you practice any one of them, you're practicing all the others. Another way is to recognize that each one relates to every other one. Each member of the path is both the result of the other seven and also the cause of the other seven. So there's this really great diagram, maybe you noticed, on page 53 of Thich Nhat Hanh's book, which is sort of a circle with the eight members of the Eightfold Path arranged around the circle and vectors connecting each one to every other one. So that each member of the path has seven vectors flowing out from it. But the vectors point in both directions, so that the causality flows both ways. So in other words, each member of the path is caused by the other seven and is a cause of the other seven. And if you look at the diagram that illustrates this, it's very beautiful. It's a sort of a beautiful geometric figure, which seems very apt. And if you think about what these eight practices amount to, they amount to pretty much everything in our lives. Everything that you do and think, how you see your life and the world. And also they include something that might not be otherwise in our lives, which is formal practice, intensive meditation practice. But meditation practice that is not unconnected to everything else in our lives and that influences everything in our lives. So the Eightfold Path is one way of describing the Buddhist path. There are other ways, lots of other ways. In Mahayana Buddhism, Bodhisattva Buddhism, usually we actually don't describe the path in terms of the Eightfold Path. We describe it in terms of the six paramitas. And there are other formulae as well to describe the progression, if it is a progression, of practice. And whatever formula you use, it sort of gives a different emphasis and somehow illuminates your practice in a different way. But the Eightfold Path is very ancient and very basic formulation. And as you know, each one of the eight is called right, you know, right meditation, right mindfulness, not just plain mindfulness, but right mindfulness. And right means not right as opposed to wrong or even exactly correct. Right means that the practice in question is aligned with the goal of the path as defined in the Four Noble Truths, which is the understanding of suffering and the end of suffering, which depends on understanding our lives the way they really are, and then living in accord with that understanding. Because you could practice powerful meditation or concentration for a selfish or destructive purpose. You could practice mindfulness, you know, with a very negative motivation. You could, like, you know, you could be a great meditator and a great, very, very mindful because it makes you a much better assassin, you know, or bank robber. And actually, probably, like, assassins and bank robbers probably are very mindful. I think you'd have to be quite mindful of details and really pay attention to be a good bank robber or assassin. So, and all the other things could be like that too. So that could be like really good concentration, but it wouldn't be right concentration. And we could have all kinds of sophisticated and correct views about things, but if they were not views in service of our purpose, they would not be right views in that sense. So right view, samyak drishti, means a number of things. First of all, that we deeply understand the Four Noble Truths, that we understand suffering, what it is really and how it comes to be, and also how it can be transformed, which is what the Four Noble Truths are. Thich Nhat Hanh mentions that also right view would include our knowing that there are those who have transformed suffering, so that we could do that too. Because if it's just a view and there's not the sense that it's something we could do, that would be a view that was lacking, right? And I know when I studied Buddhism in college, there's some of my professors that used to say, Buddhism is really great, too bad nobody can do it anymore, you know. And this was, you know, he was like one of the greatest experts in Buddhism in the world. And he really loved Buddhism and knew it inside out, but he really truly believed that the reason why nobody could do it anymore was because the world was too noisy, and Buddhism required a quiet world. And because the world was so noisy, nobody could really quite meditate. And that's what he thought. Perhaps he was right, I don't know. But that wouldn't be right view. Right view would include your knowing that suffering can be transformed, your confidence in that, and your feeling like you know people who have been able to do that. and that you could do it too. Right view also, really importantly, means that we know the difference between thoughts, deeds, and ways of speaking that will lead to the end of suffering, and thoughts, deeds, and speech that will make more suffering. In other words, we know the difference between wholesome and unwholesome dharmas. That's something that we can see and that we care about. And not only that we can see the difference, but seeing the difference, that we're committed to cultivating wholesome dharmas and letting go of unwholesome dharmas. And we're doing this not out of a sense of duty or piety, but because right view means that we really see through our own experience that there's no good to be gotten out of cultivating unwholesome dharmas. You know, it might have seemed like a good idea before, but now we know it's not a good idea. It doesn't help anything. And we don't want to do that. And we really do want to cultivate wholesome dharmas, because that's what we value and that's what we appreciate. In Dharma study, there are lots and lots of discussions and texts about wholesome and unwholesome dharmas, different lists, and you know, parsing them in one way or the other. And those are worth studying. I've studied them a lot and found them interesting and important. But really, right view is more than that. It means that we're not going by the book. We really can see and completely embrace from the standpoint of our own living and for our own good and the good of those we care about and everybody, that we really do embrace what's wholesome. The word view immediately implies view of something. You view something. And in this chapter, Thich Nhat Hanh writes about perception. And I'm always impressed over and over again with how much attention Buddhists over the generations have paid to perception itself, how perception works and what is its nature. And a perception is very much like a view, because you perceive something. With our eye, we perceive sight objects. But even if we didn't have the power of sight or hearing and so on, and there were no outside objects to perceive, we would still perceive something inside, some inner, internal sensation or feeling. So whatever we perceive is always something. And Thich Nhat Hanh here quotes the Diamond Sutra, which says, where there is perception, there is deception. Wherever there is perception, there is deception. Because from the standpoint of the teachings, perception is ultimately always misleading and false, because by its nature it involves exile and separation. I am here, the object of perception is there, and that's how come they're seeing. That's how come I can see it, because it's over there. On a fundamental level, this exile or separation is itself the root cause of suffering. So in the end, right view is no view. Or it's beyond all views. In Mahayana Buddhism, the word suchness is used to describe this non-view. It means things as they really are, without exile, without any gaps, and so without any perception, and without any view. all views are wrong views, so if we have a view that we think of as the right view, actually it isn't. Right view is no view. So that doesn't mean that our goal is to have no views, which would be impossible, just like our goal is not to shut our eyes and ears and somehow like go in a dark room. We always have perceptions and we always have views. We could get better glasses, you know, and have better sight, or even more, we could get better telescopes or microscopes and see all kinds of stuff that we couldn't see without those instruments. So in other words, we can have better views. And that's a good idea, to have the best possible view. But any view will be limited, because it will always only be what can be seen from the place where you are and with the eyes and instruments that you have. Thich Nhat Hanh writes, "The quality of our views can always be improved. From the viewpoint of ultimate reality, though, right view is the absence of all views." So practically speaking, this means that when we have a view, hopefully as accurate and well-informed a view as possible, we understand that it's a view produced in relation to our, literally, our point of view. We know that it's not ultimately true, and that our view will shift and change as our point of view shifts and changes, as it definitely will. Buddhism is a tradition with several scriptural languages. And in those languages, all the words that have to do with mind and thinking and intention and thoughts and stuff like that, consciousness, all such words are very hard to parse, you know, and translate. Words like rock or tree or dog are fairly easy to translate, because it's pretty clear exactly what they mean. But when you translate non-objective words, there are many possible words that can be fairly used. You could discuss for weeks, you know, one, the translation of one word and its implications in another language. And whatever word you choose, it's going to give you a slightly different way of looking at it. I don't know if this you noticed this when you read the chapter, but in the chapter on right view, which is we're talking about now, Thich Nhat Hanh reproduces the Chinese character for no view, or no idea, or no view. And it's the character mu or wu, and another character that means, he translates as idea, no idea. In the chapter on mindfulness, he gives you the character for mindfulness, which is the same character, actually. So in one chapter, he translates the character as idea, and in another chapter, he translates it as mindfulness, the same character. So a character might have different meaning depending on the context in the scriptures. Same character or same word might actually mean something different. So I was saying in the beginning that what's usually translated as right intention, Thich Nhat Hanh translates as right thinking. And both are fair translations of the original word. but you're going to say and think about very different things, right? If you translate intention or translate thinking. So all of that is involved in all these discussions, right? And so although we're not going into what is the actual word and all the possible translations, just so you know that that is always in the background. So now we're on to the next chapter on right thinking, which is usually right intention. And here, Thich Nhat Hanh really wants to talk about the practice of thinking, right thinking, as part of the Eightfold Path. And more or less he says something that probably you have noticed, is that a great deal of what we think is pretty useless. Right? You know, a lot of thoughts like, do I really need to think all of that? Not really. And not only is it useless, but it's what we call in Zen, and he calls it also, because his tradition is Zen, upside down thinking. Upside down thinking. Because we're literally seeing the world backwards or upside down or inside out. It's sort of like what we're seeing has some relation to the actual world, but it's upside down or inside out or mixed up. So our thinking is going to be upside down, mixed up, erroneous. Now, if we're solving a problem, like maybe Greg is fixing our coffee machine or something, and there's a problem with the machinery, he thinks it through, and he fixes it, which he did. And so that's good. That's good thinking. That's good kind of thinking. That's worthwhile thinking. Problem solving, planning. You think, you know, through, like I have to plan a journey, I have to make an airplane reservation. I think through different things, and that's very useful. I have to do that. And that's a good use of thinking. But even then, we can be thrown off by our self-centeredness, our habits of mind, our lack of clarity. And with other kinds of thinking, all the more so. Not knowing what the world really is or who we really are or what we're trying to do with our lives. Our thinking about ourselves and our lives is bound to be a bit mixed up. And this is one of the great byproducts, accidental consequences of practicing Zazen. You sit there and you see how your thinking comes and goes, and most of the time there's no use going where it goes. Let it go where it wants to go. Don't you go there. And after a while, you know, you can tell the difference between thinking that is useful or worthwhile, because not that thinking per se is bad, and thinking that works against what we're trying to do in practice and in our lives. And after a while, it's pretty obvious, the difference. Although before that, you couldn't tell the difference. After a while, it's pretty obvious. And when stupid thinking or bad thinking arises, which it usually does, you can be patient with it, not get mad at yourself for it. It's just an accident that it happened to be there. And you know, with patience, it'll go away eventually. Or, as he suggests, you can actually intentionally have a list of better thoughts that you can substitute. Or you can just slow yourself down and take some deep breaths, and the thought gradually will lose its potency and just fall away. Once you develop the confidence that you can practice with your thinking this way, and Zazen really helps, as I say, you then will feel like, well, I can have all kinds of difficult states of mind and I can survive. Even if your mind is a little wild, which will happen, right, when there are extreme or unusual circumstances, even then you can be confident that, okay, I can bear that and it'll be okay. And you see how thinking and activity go together. You realize, behave in certain ways, and you encourage very disturbed thinking. Behave in other ways, and your mind will remain calm. This is where precepts come into it. So right thinking is a process. It's an ongoing practice. Here in this section, Thich Nhat Hanh mentions the well-known Zen saying that we know from Dogen, because he uses it in Fukan Zazengi: think not thinking. Which means, think in such a way that you don't grab hold of the thinking, you don't identify with it, and commit yourself to it, and make more of it than you should. Instead, you have the ability to let the thinking come and go without necessarily believing it or without necessarily thinking it's accurate just because you thought it. So in other words, you have a way of being with your thinking that's different. And then when you really need to think something through, whether it's, you know, a plan or something practical or something emotional or subtle, usually you can do that pretty well. So now the third one here in Thich Nhat Hanh's order is right mindfulness. And I guess that in his tradition, Vietnamese Zen called Son, I think. I'm not sure that's right, and it's called Son in Korea. In his tradition, unlike in Japanese Zen, the Mindfulness Sutra and related texts like the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutra are much emphasized. I think he mentions that when he was a young monk, these sutras were taught to him and he memorized them then. And that's why, for him, mindfulness is so pivotal. In classical Zen, Chinese Zen, Chan, and also in Japanese Zen, the discourse on mindfulness isn't emphasized that much. So we don't have that much the discourse of mindfulness per se, but the practice of being present, of really disappearing into the present moment of activity, whatever it is really important in our practice. And seeing that the present moment, and this is something Dogen really stresses, seeing that the present moment is all-inclusive, eternal, and ineffable, that's at the heart of our practice too. So it's a different kind of discourse, but it really in the end is quite similar. And I would say that the traditional Zen way is a little bit more open and flexible, although harder to grasp, whereas mindfulness per se is more limited, more precise, but much easier to grasp, I think, and to practice, which is one reason, probably besides his tradition, that Thich Nhat Hanh uses it so much, because it's very easy to talk about it and understand it. But either way, the practice is to enter the present moment with a sense of acceptance, non-judgmental. That is what mindfulness is. To be with whatever is going on without needing it to be this way or that way, and just seeing it as it is. And as we all know very well, mindfulness of breathing is the basic mindfulness practice. When you're sitting or not sitting, to return to breathing is to enter the present moment of being alive in time. And when you practice that way, usually you cut through the habits that make us agitated or worried or unpresent or make create big problems sometimes for our lives that aren't even there. The Sanskrit word for mindfulness, smriti, sati in Pali, actually means to remember. So I always say, like, spiritual practice is like really easy. The hard part is remembering to keep doing it. That's the hard part. So mindfulness really means remembering to come back to the present. One of Thich Nhat Hanh's books was called The Miracle of Mindfulness, I think maybe his first really super popular book. He wrote a book early on called Zen Keys that I think nobody read, but or not very many people read. And then he wrote The Miracle of Mindfulness that was really popular. And I probably read it a long time ago. I don't remember what it says. But in this chapter, he lists seven miracles of mindfulness, which I think I never saw this list before. I think this is something that he created to make clear that mindfulness, I think people think that mindfulness is about observing your own mind and becoming really obsessed, so to speak, with all your different thinking and how it works and all of that. He wants to make clear that mindfulness is not that. Mindfulness is not hyper self-consciousness. It's the opposite. So he is emphasizing that real mindfulness actually involves others. Your loving kindness and awareness of others, your sympathy for their suffering, and your capacity to understand them as well as yourself, and to transform self and other, which I think is really true from a Mahayana Buddhist perspective, but you wouldn't really read about that in the Mindfulness Sutra. So he has seven miracles of mindfulness, and just very briefly, I'm going to just read you the list of the seven miracles of mindfulness that he talks about in this chapter. First, being present yourself. Second, making the other present. In other words, including the other person, other persons in your mindfulness. Third, nourishing the others, other, meaning including in your mindfulness the natural desire to be of service, to be caring, to be kind. Four, relieving the suffering of the other. Five, looking deeply. Six, understanding. And seven, transforming. So he includes all of these points in the practice of mindfulness, which you don't see necessarily in the mindfulness scripture. So this, to me, goes to the heart of what is so profoundly moving and appealing about Thich Nhat Hanh's presentation of Dharma, which, as we said in the beginning, we always should remember is a presentation of Dharma from the mind and heart of somebody who has been deeply, deeply wounded and traumatized by a horrific war that we can't even imagine the destruction of it that lasted his entire life. I mean, until he was an adult. This formed him. And what is uniquely moving about his presentation of Dharma is that he is both totally committed to meditation and silence and a classical monastic way of life, and equally committed to relieving the suffering of the world and transforming the world. And in his Dharma, there doesn't seem to be any difference between these two things. There's no conflict or contradiction between those two things. He thinks that they are exactly the same thing, the simple practice of mindfulness. And these seven miracles of mindfulness, I think, make that clear. Being present with things as they are, without projection, agitation, or desire, is naturally going to lead us to caring for and understanding others and doing what we can do to help. So most of the chapter is his exposition of the Mindfulness Sutra. And in brief, I want to go through that because he has, as in other places I mentioned, he has his own interpretation that is really different from other interpretations, more classical interpretations. And we've studied the Mindfulness Sutra, not for a while, but many times in Dharma Seminar. And, you know, we're aware of the different interpretations of it. So it's very interesting to me to read Thich Nhat Hanh's interpretation again and see how different it is. But I'm not going to go into this, take too long to, you know, go into all these little details. I'm just going to give you my best paraphrase of his interpretation. So there are four foundations, or he likes to say, establishments of mindfulness. This is in the sutra. Four kinds of things, experiences we should be mindful of. Body, feelings or sensations, mind and mental formations. That's the third, including emotions and all kinds of mental, emotional experience. And the last one is called objects of mind. So body, sensations, mind and its formations, and objects of mind. And the sutra is divided into those four sections, discussing each one of those practices. And in each one of the four sections, it uses this kind of strange language. It says, be aware of the body in the body. Be aware of the sensations in the sensations, etc. And that language, people interpret that in different ways, but it seems to mean that this is not a practice of observing our experience. We are practicing being completely engaged in our experience and understanding our experience from the inside, rather than somehow abstracting ourselves from our experiences so that we can analyze them. This is not exactly a practice of analysis, thinking somehow that we're separate from our experience or separate from our own self, and evaluating, right, our performance of being us. This is not going to lead us to happiness. This is not going to lead us to peace. It is only actually increase our natural restlessness. So to be mindful or aware is to be completely in whatever it is we are being mindful of. And that's why there is, of necessity, a degree of affection here and warmth. To be aware is to have a warmth, a warm feeling about what it is you're aware of, rather than a spirit of critique, analysis, and manipulation. That will make awareness much more difficult. So being mindful of the body in the body means that when we're standing, we experience our standing. We know we're standing there. When we're walking, we know we're walking. Our mind is not elsewhere. When we're breathing, we know we're breathing. When we're turning, we're turning. When we're lying down, when we're lifting, when we're putting something down, picking something up. Doing these things completely. Realizing that the body is constantly flowing and moving even when we are sitting still, and we are completely there, for that experience as it flows on. And then it's a practice to be aware of the various parts of the body, like the famous body scan. You know, we're aware of the hair on our head and our neck and our shoulders and our hands, our spine, our feet. We're aware of our sense organs and their operations. So we were aware when we're seeing, we're aware of seeing, hearing, aware of hearing. Also, we can be aware that the body is made of earth elements. The body is made of the earth. The human body is actually one of the thoughts of the earth, one of the expressions natural to the earth. And there's nothing in the body that doesn't come from the earth and return to the earth once the body breaks up. Everything returns to the earth, like we say, I guess, is it in Sandokai or Hokyo-zamai, the body returns to its elements like a baby returns to its mother. Traditionally, we say that the body is made up of earth, water, fire or warmth, and air. So we can practice noticing this in our human body. The teeth, the bones are hard, the flesh is to some extent solid. But flowing in the veins is water, or which is blood. There's flow in the body, literally. And the body is warm. There's warmth. We can feel warmth in our body. And the air is all the time coming and going inside and outside our body, and we can feel it on our cheek or whatever part of our body is not encased in clothing. So when we practice mindfulness of the four elements, we realize that there's a permeability. We're not separate, literally, from the spaces around us and other beings. We are literally, experientially flowing and mixing with everything. And we're made of the same elements that everything else is made of. Who knows where the molecules that make up our body previously have been. To be aware of air, we can practice awareness of breathing by paying attention to the breath in and out. Thich Nhat Hanh recommends that we do this by counting breaths from 1 to 10, and then he says backwards from 10 to 1. I don't think I ever heard anybody recommend that one before. Counting from 10 to 1 is a very common place in many scriptures, texts. He offers using words: in, out, deep, slow, smile, release, and then his famous little poem, present moment, wonderful moment. And that's why, thinking of this, we were practicing in the beginning my little adaptation of that, which I messed up, I forgot. It's deep, not long. Deep, yeah, deep, slow, soft, quiet. And it's really a nice practice to just use those words. Especially if your mind is agitated, it helps. And it's very interesting how words can do that. Words can actually have a somatic quality when you use them with the breath or when you use them slowly in contemplation. The words begin to feel like they're changing your body. It's an interesting thing. Something like that happens in koan practice. In Zen, just contemplating a phrase till it changes your body and your heart. Probably this happens all the time whenever we're speaking or listening or reading or writing, but usually we experience it more in the head. So that's the first. And there are other things. He doesn't talk about the cemetery, famous cemetery contemplations, but they're also in the Mindfulness Sutra where you observe the breaking down of a corpse, literally. The second establishment of mindfulness is mindfulness of the feelings or sensations, and this one is something really simple. It involves noticing our immediate reactive animal impulse to things that come into our consciousness, like hot or cold or pain or pleasure, any object in the mind. And when anything comes into the mind, we have an automatic gut reaction. I like that, I don't like it, ouch, you know, I don't, get me away from this. Or it might be we have both reactions, or it might be that we're neutral, we don't really have much of a reaction. And when you breathe deeply and calmly, the sensations or feelings, it's the same word thing, same word, feelings, sensations. Not feelings in the sense of emotions, that's another thing. Feelings in the sense of gut reactions. When you breathe deeply and calmly, these sensations, which are usually pretty agitated and reactive, slow down, and you can see them and bring some peace to them. And that helps a lot. The third establishment is mind, citta, or mental formations, citta samskara. And these are all the different possible, more complex states of mind that involve, you know, thinking and calculation and emotions of various kinds. Some of these are really positive and helpful, and if possible, we should cultivate them. Things like faith, devotion, humility, self-respect, love, care, consideration, compassion. Others could be positive or negative, like sleepiness, which is great when you're tired, but not so great when you're driving, you know. Remorse, which can be really good when you did bad things, but really bad if you torture yourself with guilt. Thinking, which we already said could be good, could not be so good. And then there's a third category, which they call kleshas, or sometimes ashravas, meaning unwholesome or leaky mental states like anger, doubt, pride, hypocrisy, jealousy, greediness, dishonesty, sneakiness, etc., etc. Many of these can be present in the mind a lot of the time, just sort of like residually, and you don't notice it necessarily until something happens, and then they really come flaring out. But with mindfulness, we notice these things in the mind, all of them, the positive ones, the negative ones, the neutral ones, and we have the willingness to let them be there and just bring peace to them with the breath. Earlier in the book, I think last week, we talked about how when you practice meditation, when you breathe, the mind calms down, you kind of get a rest, you know, that you don't get even when you're sleeping. And then, he says, with that restfulness, profound restfulness, there can be healing. So, just to be mindful, this is the thing that is quite miraculous. You know, the word miracle of mindfulness is very apt, because you don't have to fix the thing that is troublesome. You just have to be aware of it and breathe with it and let it be there. And it sort of changes without your making it change. And you'll come to see why it's there in the first place, and appreciate that it's there when it's no longer driving you. Another thing that is really, really important about mental formations that I think he mentions, but I don't think the Mindfulness Sutra says this, although it might imply it. When you begin to notice all this stuff in your mind, in your heart, you realize that it's not your fault. You know what I mean? You realize, oh, because this and this and this, this and this and this, just like it would be true of anybody. In other words, these emotions, mental formations, are pretty much what everybody feels, depending on the conditions under which they've been living. So when you're mindful of your own mental formations, you will eventually understand that you're like everyone and everyone's like you, and so this will increase your compassion and your understanding for others, and that will increase your compassion and your understanding for yourself. And again, there are various Buddhist systems that list all, if you can imagine, list and categorize all possible mental states. They do. And they're very interesting, but we don't necessarily need that kind of study, because we're just going to be aware of all this stuff in ourselves. And finally, the last one, mindfulness of objects of mind. And this one, I find there are many different interpretations, and this one of Thich Nhat Hanh is really good. I like this one. He interprets it as being mindful of phenomena, mindful of things that are out there. Dharmas. That's what literally it means, mindfulness of dharmas. Here he's saying, more or less, that this final establishment of mindfulness, which depends on the previous three, is mindfulness of reality as it really is. Which is, in other words, full clarification of the teachings. We realize that all objects of the senses, including all objects of mind and heart, all emotions, all things that we are aware of, that we're mindful of, are empty. There's no substance to them. There's no fundamental, hard and fast, fixed reality to them. It's just a flow of impressions. And these impressions are everywhere connected to everything else. And therefore, everything is as it must be. And everything is in a state of healing and transformation. So we can love ourselves and love everyone else, love the world, even the way it is, because we can really see it and really understand how it came to be as it is. And then we can finally let go of our suffering and really see our identity with everything. That, for Thich Nhat Hanh, is the fourth and last foundation of mindfulness. So, we talked about right view, right thinking, and right mindfulness. So, my question for you is, in all this, what do you find most challenging? What is the most challenging in these three practices for you? Take any one of them. So if Neil will put people in the computer into groups of three, we can sort of spontaneously organize ourselves into groups of three. And let's take about 15 minutes for this, four, four, and four, and then a few more extra minutes. So what is most difficult? What do you find most challenging in all this? And maybe you don't have to think about it much, but just what comes up for you when I ask you that question? Thank you for listening. Hello. On the computer, yeah, great.